Chapter 32, please, in your Bibles with me, Exodus chapter 32. The people, this people, have sinned a great sin. We've looked at this for some weeks now. We've looked at the first six verses. I'd like to read those verses again. This is a passage that's referred to many times throughout the rest of the Old Testament and even in the New Testament. When Stephen preaches his sermon in Acts chapter 7, he makes reference to this incident. This is something that was very traumatic, something that was very serious in Israel's history. So we're spending time on it so that we understand the seriousness of sin. Exodus 32:1 says, "And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, Up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what is become of him. And Aaron said unto them, Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people brake off the golden earrings which were in their ears, and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand, and fashioned it with a graving tool, after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt." Later on in the Old Testament, it's referred to as a god. Verse 5, "And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said unto Moses, Go, get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed thereunto and said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said unto Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, that I may consume them, and I will make of thee a great nation." The sin is so great that God says, I am ready to consume them. Why have we lost the fact that sin is so great? What the children did in these verses, if you look at verses 30 and 31, Moses calls a great sin. Let's read verses 30 and 31. "It came to pass on a morrow that Moses said unto the people, Ye have sinned a what? A great sin." Look again at verse 31. When Moses talks to the Lord, he says, "Oh, this people have sinned what? It is a great sin." Moses says this both to the people and to the Lord. It is easy for us, folks, as sinners, even though we're redeemed, to become callous to sin. All sin is serious. We know from the Bible in 1 John 3:4 that sin is the transgression of the law. And they have transgressed God's law. Admittedly, some sins are more grievous than others. All sin is sin, but great implies that there's levels of seriousness. And yet, when we are focused on the levels of sin, we can get to the place where we discount the seriousness of some sins and we say, well, at least it's not. And this is what we tend to do in our churches. We look outside the church and look at society and the tremendous wickedness that's out there and thereby excuse some of our, air quotes, lesser sins. And we need to realize that all sin is an affront to God. For one thing, we may think that if a sin is not great, if it's not as great as what we see in Exodus chapter 32, then I'm okay to commit lesser sins. But I want you to think about a verse that you'll find earlier than Exodus 32. It's Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5, where the Bible says, "And God saw that the wickedness of man was what in the earth? It was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth. The Hebrew word for great there does not refer to the immensity of the sin or the weight of it or how heavy it was. It literally refers to the root of that is many or numerous. And the sin in the world at that time was many, it was much, it was numerous. In fact, the same word great in Genesis 6:5 is translated many in Genesis 30:21-34, referring to many days. It's translated much in Genesis 30:43 when it talks about much cattle. So the sins in Noah's day were so many, it was so numerous, it was everywhere. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Then you get to Genesis chapter 18, and God is talking about a couple of cities. And he says this in Genesis 18:20, the Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great. Now, it was the cry. It was the cry of their sin that was great. That word great again has to do with many. It was manifold. It was numerous. It was everybody was involved. It was just everybody was doing it. And then it says, and because their sin is very grievous. That's the word that means heavy, weighty. And God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah because of their wickedness. But you get to Exodus 32 and you got the word greater. You have sinned a great sin. No longer is this the word that says many or numerous. There's one sin here. And the word here, unlike the other word, never refers to being numerous. Instead, it means being great in size or importance. The same word is used in Exodus 32:10. Since you're in Exodus 32, look at verse 10. Again, God says, now, therefore, let me alone that my wrath may wax hot against them and that I may consume them, and I will make of thee a what kind of a nation? Same word as the great sin, but this is a great. And Moses, I will make of you an important nation. The same word is used in verse 11, describing God's power. Look at verse 11. Moses besought the Lord his God and said, Lord, why doth thy wrath wax hot against thy people with which thou hast brought forth out of the land of Egypt with a great power? There's the word great, great power. So the word great refers to God's power. Moses is described in Exodus chapter 11 and verse 3. Go back to Exodus chapter 11 and look at verse 3. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very, he was great in the land. He was a man of importance. I'm trying to have you understand the word great because this people have sinned a great sin. God is described as great in Deuteronomy 10:17. The book of Psalms talks a lot about how great the Lord is. In fact, 145 and verse 3, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. But when that word describes sin, it's highlighting how important that sin is. Not as if it is something that is to be looked up to, but important in the way that it should be looked down upon because of its immensity. Genesis 39 is a story of Joseph. And he's trying to be seduced. Potiphar's wife is trying to seduce him. And Joseph uses this word twice. He says, there is none greater in this house than I. Joseph recognized his importance in the house of Potiphar. Neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And then there's one other time, at least, when that word great is used in reference to sin, and it's one that we made reference to last week. Would you go with me again to 2 Kings chapter 17? Because we see that there's a king who comes along later who mimics what the children of Israel did here in Exodus 32. So 2 Kings chapter 17 and verse 21. For he, that is God, rent Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king, and Jeroboam drave Israel from following the Lord and made them sin, a great sin. Folks, where there is great sin, there is great consequence. There is great calamity. And you're going to see that happen here in Exodus 32. But Jeremiah makes reference to this in Jeremiah chapter 16, a passage I'd like you to turn to again, please. Jeremiah 16. Let's read verses 10 through 13 of Jeremiah 16. And it shall come to pass when thou shalt show these people all these words, and they shall say unto thee, wherefore hath the Lord pronounced all this great evil against us? Or what is our iniquity? Or what is our sin that we have committed against the Lord our God? Then shalt thou say unto them, because your fathers have forsaken me, saith the Lord, and have walked after other gods, and have served them, and worshipped them, and have forsaken me, and have not kept thy law. And ye have done worse than your fathers, for behold, ye walk every one after the imagination of his evil heart, that they may not hearken unto me. Therefore will I cast you out of this land into a land that ye know not, neither ye nor your fathers, and there shall ye serve other gods day and night, where I will not show you favor. Now you go back to verse 10, and God says, Jeremiah is talking, wherefore hath the Lord pronounced all this great evil against us? That word evil is calamity. It has to do with God, because of your great sin, has allowed great calamity to come against you. And so we need to understand, when we go back to Exodus 32, the seriousness of this sin. We tend to read over passages like this and not stop and think and study and really understand what's taking place here. Because there are at least four responses in this chapter that show us the seriousness of sin. And we're going to get to the first one tonight, and only the first one. And here's the response that is given in this chapter that shows us the seriousness of sin. And it's the word indignation. Indignation. We saw it when we read verse 10 of Exodus 32. God says to Moses, let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them. Now, I want to talk about that tonight. We're going to look at two things eventually. Tonight, we're going to look at the wax hot wrath of God. Next time, we're going to look at the wax hot wrath of Moses. There's something interesting about the wax hot wrath of God that I want you to see. Notice what God says to Moses in verse 7. Go, get thee down. Now, when Moses is recounting this incident later in Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 12, he says, God says, arise, get thee down quickly. Due to the seriousness of this sin, Moses, get down there right now. But before God allows him to go, God finishes by telling him the things that we see in verses 7, 8, 9, and 10. God says this to Moses, go get thee down quickly, even before telling him what's happened. First thing God says, go down there quickly. That gets Moses' attention. Then God tells him. And God tells Moses what the people have done before Moses has even witnessed it himself. So Moses learns how this matter was viewed on the mount from God's perspective. I find that significant. I liked what George Bush said. Again, for those of you who aren't familiar, I'm talking about a commentator who lived in the early 1800s. That George Bush, not the president. In his commentary, he said this. This ought, in fact, to have been their chief concern. Not how they regarded this sin, but how it was looked upon from above. But this was neglected. And the same neglect is continually evinced by heedless transgressors intent upon sensual pleasures. Ah, did they but reflect that there is an unsleeping eye ever watchful over their career and a true estimate incessantly making up of their conduct, which will finally come to them in the form of a fearful indictment? What a salutary damper would it throw upon their profane hilarities. How needful is it for us often while sporting on the plain to think of the judgment formed of our conduct on the mount? While we're sporting on the plain, let's think of how God sees this from the mount. Moses, get down there. Here's what the people are doing. So before Moses sees what they have done, God says, verse 10, so Moses is to go down quickly, not motivated by the wrath of God, but by the commandment of God. Because is God full of wrath? He's not. I want you to notice the wording here in just a moment. Because you'll notice that God's wrath has not yet waxed hot. Notice it again, verse 10. Now therefore let me alone that my wrath may wax hot against them. His wrath has not yet waxed hot or yet become hot. But he tells Moses, let me alone. Literally, Moses, stay settled. You rest here. I'm going to go down and I'm going to consume them. These words, Bush says, which seem to forbid, were really intended to encourage Moses in his suit. They are not indeed a positive comment to him to pray in behalf of Israel, but they indicated what it was that would stay the divine hand from punishing, and were equivalent to saying, if you intercede for them, my hands are tied, and I cannot execute the deserved vengeance. Of this hint, Moses would not be slow to avail himself. It's kind of interesting, because you read in the next part of it where Moses begins to intercede for these people. And what is happening here is God is really introducing to Moses the idea that he could intercede for these people in a very roundabout way. Israel deserves his waxed hot wrath. Why? They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them, verse 7. The last times we've been looking at this, we've looked at the three signs of a person who has become hard. It doesn't start that way. People don't just all of a sudden get hard. There's a process to becoming hard. Do you remember the three signs? Impatience, imaginative, idolatrous. Those three signs are also steps to becoming hard and stiff-necked. God calls them a stiff-necked people in verse 9. Remember what the word hard-necked means. It's an expression based on farm animals, refusing the yoke upon their necks to avoid work. Stubborn, headstrong, pig-headed. I was reading another commentator and he says, it is likened to a horse that stiffens his neck when the driver pulls the rein right or left, thus refusing to go the way that it should. Stiff-necked. How many of you have ever ridden a horse who would not allow the reins to control him? How many of you have ever had an experience on the horse as a result? Let me tell you of an experience I had. I took our quarter horse out into the pasture. I was probably 12 or 13 years old. And my dad had always said, never run the horses through the yard. I took High Boy out into the pasture with my brothers. We were riding our horses. And High Boy had this bad habit that when you turned around to go back, he would just automatically run. And so I was out in the pasture, and I turned him, and he took off. Little did I know that my dad and my two oldest brothers, Delmer and Terry, are there, and they're working on the tractor scoop, and the scoop's up in the air. And it's got these spikes about this long on it. And that is up about this high. And I am pulling back the reins as hard as I'm trying to turn High Boy. He will not turn. He is stiff-necked. He is hard-necked. He will not respond. And we come in and come right around the barn, and there, too late, I see it. And I can't do it. The horse will not obey me. And the horse, those spikes, right into the spike. And it cut his leg wide open. And it was such a jolt that I went flying off and landed on my back on the gravel driveway. and the horse went limping down to the barn. A stiff-necked horse. The horse, actually, we took care of the horse and he was fine later on. Had a huge gash in his leg. But I've also ridden horses. My brothers would always have me break the horses, before Uncle Mike would, before your dad would, because I was the lightest one. So they'd put me on the horse. We had a horse named Thunder. And Thunder liked, you're not going to believe this, Thunder liked to climb trees when you got on him. He would literally go to the nearest tree and start putting his hooves up and start going up the tree. Not responding to the rider. Stiff-necked. That's these people. God is giving them command. They don't respond. God gives you a command. You don't respond. You do what you want. You go your own way. You don't respond. Mere weeks before chapter 32, the people had made a promise. Mere weeks. See their promise in chapter 19 of Exodus. 19:8, and all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord hath spoken, we will do." And Moses returned the words of the people unto the Lord. Go to chapter 24. All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do, they said there in 19. Chapter 24, verse 3, and Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord hath said, we will do." Will we do? Verse 4, and Moses wrote all the words of the Lord and rose up early in the morning and builded an altar under the hill and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent the young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Here's a covenant made with blood. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has said, will we do and be obedient." Folks, this is mere weeks before what you find in chapter 32. Simply weeks. And it is so common for us, even as God's people, sometimes to make a covenant with God and make a promise and maybe go forward or make a decision in our seats and say, "Lord, I will now, from now on, I will do such and such." And we break the promise. No wonder God says they have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. And really what you're reading here in Exodus chapter 32 reminds us of what Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 2. And this I want you to see. 2 Peter chapter 2. Talking about false prophets and false teachers that are among the people. And here's what Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 2 verse 20. "For if, after they have escaped the pollutions of the world, through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein and overcome, the latter end is worse with them than the beginning." They had escaped, these children of Israel had escaped the pollutions of the world through the deliverance that God had provided. And according to Peter, it would have been better for them not to even have known the way of righteousness than, after they have known it, to turn from the holy commandment delivered unto them. Verse 21, "For it had been better for them not to have even known the way of righteousness than, after they have known it, to turn from the holy commandment delivered unto them." I've given you illustrations. I've told you of guys I have known who everybody thought was a Christian, guys who were studying for the ministry, fellow students, ministerial students of mine, who today deny that God even exists. They deny God, or they're agnostic. And look at verse 22. Because people say, "Well, was that guy even saved?" Not according to verse 22, but "It has happened unto them according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again." How many have ever seen a dog lick up his vomit? Isn't that appetizing? They go back to, would you ever see a sheep do that? No. But an unsaved man who may have seemed to have been saved? You'll know what he is when he goes back and licks up his own vomit. Figuratively, he goes back to the things that he at one time claimed he was delivered from, but he goes back to his vomit. And then it says, and the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mire. You can take that 4-H sow and clean her up and take her there before the judges, and they can say, wow, what a beautiful animal. But as soon as you give that sow the opportunity to go to the mud, what's it going to do? It's going to go run into the mud. Because what is it? It's a sow. A dog's going to lick up its vomit. Why? Because it's a dog. A sheep avoids the mud, and it avoids the vomit. Because it's truly a sheep. It had been better if they had never known. That tells me something, that one day these guys who at one time claimed to be saved and have turned, it is better if they had never even known the way of righteousness than to have known the truth and turned from it. So we see idolatry in Exodus chapter 32. That's that great sin. And the fact that we are faced with the temptation of idolatry today is evidenced in the New Testament commands that are given. See one of the commands in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul, writing to the church at Corinth, says this in verses 6 and following in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Now these things were our examples to the intent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be ye idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. What is that referring to? Exodus 32. And then you look at verse 14. Wherefore, here's the whole point Paul's trying to make. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from what? Idolatry. Folks, he's telling this to a New Testament church. Do you think that we in our churches today need to be admonished to flee from idolatry? You've heard this before many times. We tend to think of idolatry as having some kind of an idol somewhere. But idolatry, and you've heard this, is anything you put before the Lord. And if you go to 1 John, this is the last passage we'll look at tonight. Go to 1 John. And he says in chapter 1 who he is addressing. 1 John is addressed to those whom, about whom he could say in chapter 1 and verse 3, truly, our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. John is writing to people, and these they are believers because he says, our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. And yet, what's the last thing he says to them in this epistle? Go to it in chapter 5. What's the last thing he says? It's the same thing that we need to be admonished of. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. Let it be so. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. That tells me something. It tells you something, that even as believers, we have a problem. We can be tempted with idolatry. Idolatry has to do with what we can feel with our hands and see with our eyes. Not just in what we worship, but in what gives us delight. You know, I'd rather watch a football game than be in church. I would rather do this than be, I would rather, what are we, what is our priority? What are we doing? It is the opposite of walking by faith, because walking by faith is very difficult to do. It's hard. Because I cannot see it. I cannot feel it. And so what gave these children of Israel such a rush is the fact that they can see their God and they can worship the God that they can see. And the Bible says, though, that we walk by faith, not by sight. And without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he that cometh to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. There is only one preventative. and only one safeguard from succumbing to the temptation of idolatry. It's to be constantly occupied with Jesus Christ. Hebrews chapter 12, looking unto Jesus. Looking unto Jesus, keeping our focus upon Him. I'm closing early tonight because I know some folks need to get home due to the weather. But folks, let's remember the seriousness of sin. This people have sinned a great sin. God's anger has not yet waxed hot. But Moses' anger waxes hot after he has interceded for these people. He pleads with God there on the mount, and then he comes down. And his anger is hot when he sees what they're doing. No wonder he's probably thinking when he comes down, no wonder God was angry. I am looking and seeing what these people are doing. And one of the things we need to understand is this, that we should be angry at what God is angry at.